business and labor.
Are geographically recognized.
Open up the House Committee on Business and Labor for April 3rd, 2003. And open a public hearing on House Bill 3076. Jan, if you could summarize what it is.
Madam Chair, committee members, this bill directs Foley to study methods of resolving post-employment disputes and to report to the legislature by September 2014. Declares an emergency effective on passage, and there are no amendments.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Hicks, welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members. I'm Representative Woolley.
All these people are here for you.
District 3, I hope so. What an honor. Wonderful. Representative Hicks, House District 3. House Bill 3076 is not a long bill, but it could be very substantial in its effect if the committee were to choose to go forward with it. The bill was brought to me in concept by a constituent who had a post-labor dispute and found himself embroiled in the ever more common scenario of having to find an attorney, having to deal with somebody else's attorney, and having to contemplate going to court, and having to spend a lot of money on something that didn't necessarily involve a lot in dispute of wages that were claimed. So what I decided to do was think about whether there could be a better way, and so I consulted who I deemed to be the experts on this matter, the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and we, I think, have come to a concept here that has resulted in this bill that essentially requires them to study various methods of resolving post-employment disputes and report back. I think the direction that this would go would be basically a mediation sort of concept, something that would occur prior to and in hopefully in lieu of the legal kind of dispute that would typically happen when an employer and past employee simply cannot agree on what was owed. And so So I have had the bill drafted and submitted for your consideration to simply ask Boley to study various methods of resolving these disputes. If they do come back with some form of mediation, and I do believe other states use mediation in their post-employment dispute practices. California has a very elaborate mediation system, for example. If they do come back with something that will work for Boley, then I'd be even more interested in perhaps looking at this for other parts of the government. There's no reason why, if there's a model that works for Boley, we couldn't kind of translate that to other disputes that the government winds up getting involved in or in the middle of, and potentially save some tax dollars thusly, and also a lot of angst among the citizenry. So that's what I have to say about 3076.
That sounds good. Would you like Elizabeth Kushwa to come up also?
And yes, thank you.
So we can have a whole panel for questions. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Daugherty, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Kushwa with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Representative Hicks reached out early, to Commissioner Avakian on this bill, and we talked a little about the several methods of solving these sorts of disputes. For example, California does have a mediation model on this. Currently, Boley uses a couple of methods for resolving disputes, including settlements and hearings outside of the court system. At this time, though, we do not have an alternate dispute resolution process because two administrative law judges are required for this, and one to work as the mediator and one in case the mediation fails. Our legal policy advisor, Marsha Olemiller, is currently completing the mediation training so that our administrative prosecution unit can offer mediation without compromising our ALJ. Initially, Boley will probably study these cases in enforcement to see if mediation results in resource savings or if the parties like this sort of process. We have the ability to reach out to other states' agencies as well to determine how post-employment disputes are being handled and to report the findings back to the legislature.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Any questions of the panel? Actually, I have one. It's a good idea. Is this something that, in fact, maybe a suggestion possibly to look at the mediation services that Employment Relations Board has? And they've been in business for a long time mediating contract disputes, but the principles are the same kind of idea. And I know U of O has a dispute resolution program and all of that. So I think there's a lot of resources here in Oregon to go through and deal with it, but I think it's a very good idea.
Okay.
Okay.
Representative Holby.
Thank you. Elizabeth, before you get away.
Darn, almost.
I was curious how Boley, you know, since you're there, how, speaking of resources, how Boley would find the resources to do this kind of study. Is it something you that Boley thinks they can absorb, just preliminary feeling on that, or do you really know, or is it going to take resources from other operations inside Boley?
Chair Doherty, Representative Holby, to be candid, we would probably need a serious intern working on a lot of this stuff if we had one. Otherwise, it probably would require resources, additional resources, or we would have to move something from another place. But depending on our intern situation, I'll let you know.
Thanks.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you very much for bringing this to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, those are the only two people signed up for House Bill 3076. Anyone else would like to speak on this bill? Okay, if not, close public hearing on House Bill 3076 and open up a public hearing on House Bill 2669. Representative Fredericks, Representative Matthews. Jan, can you summarize?
Madam Chair, committee members, this bill extends certain employee protections to persons who are performing work for educational purposes. Declares an emergency. There are no amendments.
Thank you. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. I'm Representative Lou Frederick, representing House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. I'm here to tell you about House Bill 2669 concerning the fair treatment of interns. Now, in a perfect world, we would not need this bill. Of course, you could say that about just about any bill. There are those who will argue that we don't need this bill now. Actually, the arguments against it will probably rest on two seemingly contradictory positions. One, the law isn't needed because it doesn't happen anyway, and we are much too enlightened as a society to need a law to tell us to not discriminate. Number two, businesses will fail if they are not allowed to discriminate. In response to the first argument, I have to point out the energy with which bills like this are opposed. If it's no big deal, why do some people think it would be catastrophic? In response to the second argument, I have to ask, really? And then I have to point you to ORS 659A and the kinds of behavior covered in the statute. This statute is simply about fairness. Which forms of discrimination is so important that your business model depends on it? Is it sexual harassment, racial discrimination, discrimination based on disability when the disability doesn't affect job performance, discrimination based on sex or religion? Which one of these is so important to you that you are willing to state in public that you simply will not accept interns if you have to treat them fairly? Because, folks, that is what this boils down to. There's nothing novel about this argument. I've heard it all my life. There are folks in this world who believe that they have a right to treat others unfairly, and laws that say, no, you don't, are one of the major reasons we call ourselves a civilization. So I'm kind of surprised every time I'm reminded discrimination still has a constituency. ORS 659A provides a number of specific protections against discrimination for employees. This bill would extend certain of these protections to interns. It is not a wholesale extension of all the protections accorded to employees, but a selective one, based on those protections that make sense to interns. Commissioner Avakian may be here, and Elizabeth Kushwa, who you just heard from the Bureau of Labor and Industries, will be able to explain some of the details. And I'll pass it along to my twin.
Thank you. Yes. How about that? Thank you very much. And Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Greg Matthews, State Representative out of House District 50, the great city of Gresham. Here today in support of House Bill 2669 and proud to be with my good friend, Representative Lou Frederick. This is an issue that we have been kind of tackling together for quite some time. And it's a little odd that we couldn't get any ground last session. This issue, as he had said, is about the fair protection of our interns and putting them at the same level of protection as you would any other employee. He did a good job of setting this bill up, but I want to put it into just a couple different contexts in terms of what I've already heard about the bill. I have heard that there's a good chance that OUS might be opposing the bill because they see this as creating fewer opportunities for their students if their interns are are protected, that businesses would be less likely to take in an intern if they would have to follow the same guidance of the law as they would with any other employee. To that, I would say this. I would find it odd that a university system would be opposed to a bill that would protect the very students that they're teaching when they're in the workplace conducting their studies. I also find it odd that the business would take that position. And I want to be clear, though. The business industry themselves has not flat out told me no. They're interested in finding a way to do something. But I don't know what that would be. Once you start to scale this thing down and start peeling back the layers of this onion, you start to minimize any protection for anybody, and it begins to make less and less sense as you start to carve out one or two components of a law that clearly protects employees in the workplace. So I'll leave you with this, and I found this to be rather telling, and I'll put it in context that we all can understand, because we are in this building every day, and we know who else is in this building. We know who helps us conduct our duties. We know who helps us in responsibilities in the office. We all rely on interns, most of us. So while I'm attending the mandatory sexual harassment training this year, which we all, of course, attend, it's mandatory, with all employees of the state, I'm seated on the House floor, which is the place where they teach it, of course, and I'm there with my staff member, and it's being taught by Charlie Cheek, who actually is the author of this bill or the one that I had drafted, which together, but he's been working on this issue with us. And he completes, you know, the day and says, are there any questions? And this is after he's already exposed everybody to what this law does and the protections that we have as employees and the responsibilities of the employer. And I said, I have one. Forgive me, but how are interns protected under this bill in this building? And he said, Representative, that's a good question. They're not. I think that's wrong. I just think it's wrong. I look at the folks that help us do these duties. I look at the exposure that they are at lots of different levels, and I think that we have an obligation to ensure a safe workforce for everybody in the workplace. And I got to tell you, my kids are far from it, but it'll happen fast. And my oldest, who's 12 years old, will at some point be applying for an internship. I'd sure like to know that she's protected from some of the things that are covered in this bill. So thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the time of the committee today.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Kushwa, why don't you come up and join the panel and give a presentation? Okay, thank you. And they'll ask questions. And for those of you waiting with the first panel on 3390, and that's Senator Rosenbaum and so on, when we finish this group, we're going to, you know, finish this, gavel you in, then gavel you back out and do a work session. So so for the folks that are waiting, that's what the situation is.
Elizabeth, would you like you to bring up Maria Orr okay. Miller?
She must bring her chair with her.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning again, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Kushwa, and the Legislative Director with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I'd like to thank both Representative Frederick and Matthews for helping us with this bill.
Thank you.
And give you a little bit of background on exactly what this bill does to help you kind of wrap your brains around it. Interns and volunteers are protected under both state and federal wage and hour law, employment-related anti-discrimination laws, and the protections offered under ORS 659A and Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 do not specifically cover them in the workplace. Oregon law does not offer specific protections to these workers because these statutes apply only to employees. HB 2669 extends only the anti-discrimination statutes to individuals working for educational purposes, whether paid or unpaid, and whether there is another compensation or benefit of the work. Educational purposes, though not defined specifically in statute, is used throughout the ORS. For example, ORS 408 refers to veterans receiving financial aid for educational purposes. ORS 36232 refers to mediation disclosure for educational purposes. HB 2669 does not extend the employment relationship to any other employment statute, only the anti-discrimination statutes. The protections listed in lines 6 through 8 of the bill include prohibitions against discrimination for these sorts of things: race, color, religion, sex, this includes sexual harassment, sexual orientation, national origin, marital status or age, uniformed service, disability, mental health treatment, testifying in a criminal proceeding, status as a victim of domestic violence or sexual assault, or even smoking during non-working hours. These civil rights and workplace protections exist for all employees, but not for this group of workers. Students and other workers performing, people performing work for educational purposes, should have the same protections as the employee who is working next to them. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Norlin, or Chair Doherty, and members of the committee, I'm Marcia Ole Miller, Legal Policy Advisor for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I think Representatives Fredericks and Matthews have covered most of the major issues, and Ms. Cushwa, I don't really have a lot to add. I did bring some testimony, which I hope you have in front of you, that kind of summarizes the bill, what protections it does provide and what it doesn't. It doesn't provide any kind of leave rights, any kind of wage and hour rights. It's not a way to turn interns into employees. It's a way to protect them from otherwise illegal discrimination that is covered in many other situations. And BOLI itself has, over the years, had a number of interns, and we've been very happy to have them among us, and we've learned from them, and we hope they learn from us. We try to provide them with all those protections and also with the dignity and respect that they deserve for coming and providing their services to us. And, of course, they're doing it for credits from their school, but they're also providing a valuable service. So I understand, at least unless I'm misunderstanding, that there may be a concern that somehow that institutions of education that are sending these interns out could become liable under the bill. That's certainly not our intent or understanding of the bill. The way that the bill is worded is intended to hold the employer liable who is hosting the intern for these protections while the intern's working for them, not to confuse the institution of education as the one who's doing the actions, the illegal actions we're talking about, or those of employers who are hosting interns. So with that, I don't have anything more to add. I think most of the points have been fairly well covered. I'll take any questions if anyone
has any. Are there any questions for the panelists? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I did have a question when it comes to the university system. See if I can figure out how to get this through. But anyway, as an employer, if I send an employee somewhere else, kind of like what the university system is sending an intern to a place, I as an employer am responsible if I knew or should have known about any sort of like sexual harassment, for instance. Why would the university not also be subject in the same way?
Well, under this law, it wouldn't. What we're talking about is the intern in the situation of the employment setting. There's nothing about how the intern got there or any sort of responsibility on, you know, all kinds of educational institutions place interns, and we have dealt with paralegal interns, law student interns, private school interns, high school interns. I mean, we don't, I'm not aware of any set of laws that talks about, you know, the knew or should have known as far as schools. That's not our area of expertise. Maybe there are some laws if someone wanted to make a case that they would find that they could use, but that is not what this is about. And I'm not really, I can't really speak to that because it's not, that would not be involved in this bill.
I guess I would just make the comment that it seems like it should apply equally.
Okay, because I have a follow-up question to that, but Representative Witz, next in line.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make sure that this bill applies to educational institutions across the board, not just to university apprenticeship programs, but to high school and perhaps even junior high school apprenticeships as well.
Well, the scope of the type of interns it covers is really spelled out in the bill. And I believe that's on page 1, lines
8 through 10, where it says an individual is considered to be in an employment relationship with an employer if the individual is performing work for educational purposes. That's very broad, so yes. It doesn't restrict it to particular types of educational institutions or curricula.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. And just as a follow-up, because I have an intern who, even though he goes to the University of Oregon, he did not go through the U of O to get this internship. He happened to be, you know, somebody from like the neighborhood or from the Tigard area that was interested and just called on their own. But so in that case, he's not necessarily hooked up to a university, but would still have the same protections and so on. Is that correct?
Well, there is a class of volunteers. You know, public bodies are allowed to, under wage and hour laws, to have volunteers working for them who aren't necessarily enrolled in an educational program that's going to give them credits for that experience. This is talking about individuals performing work for educational purposes, which wouldn't necessarily encumber or involve only people getting credits. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm not a legal expert to interpret this statute, yeah. But
it is broad enough to encompass something like that. Yeah.
Educational purposes is a broad term.
Representative Doherty, that was the intention of the bill, to cover anyone working under those circumstances as well.
Okay, great. Thank you. Representative Holvey?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Along those lines, this is the way I read it, too, that the person wouldn't have to be associated with an institution of education to be performing services for educational purposes. My question is, are volunteers covered under this bill or another provision for these same protections?
I can speak from Bowley's experience on that. A lot of the people that we've had come to work for us in the last few years, particularly perhaps because of the economy in part, have been students who left university and then couldn't find jobs and didn't want to delay starting their career path, and so they were seeking a volunteer experience even though they weren't any longer enrolled so they could start their education in their career, and I think that they would fall under this. We've also had people who were between jobs and trying to figure out what they wanted to do next, and when they come to us, they don't say, I want to shuffle papers and file things. They say, wow, I'm interested in what your agency does. I'd like to learn more. I'd like to learn if this is an area where I might fit in, where I might have a future. And we consider, we look on volunteers and interns as people who came to us to learn about what we do and how they might, the skills they have that might fit in that environment. It doesn't exclude volunteers, and educational purposes is a broad term.
Okay, other questions of the panelists? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, next we have Emma Calloway, Bob Junta, I always mispronounce your name, and J.L. Wilson.
Good morning, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Emma Calloway. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Student Association, and we're here today to speak in support of House Bill 2669. So this bill, in our understanding, changes the civil liberties protections for internships. And I just want to express from the Student Association perspective, an internship is proving to be more and more vital to the success of job search after college. It's becoming an integral part of the educational fabric that students are participating in. And we believe that extending civil liberties to those internships is a vital portion of that. I'd like to mention a couple things. One is that this is a discussion around internships and work placement and work experience that's happening on the federal level as well. Congresswoman Bonamici is working on federal legislation that would incentivize internships. So I think that's a reflection that the concept of internships is becoming, you know, like I said, an integral part of post-secondary education. The job market seems to expect this from college graduates, and there are a number of different ways that you can obtain an internship. internship while part of post-secondary education, one of which is through the university, and that's a great option, and there are a number of ways that students are protected. There are an infinite number of ways to take on an internship that is not protected by the university or the statutes of an institution or the institution itself. So students are taking upon internships from, you know, outside, from businesses, from, you know, political internships, a number of different ways. And we also very much appreciate that this bill extends down into high school students and younger students, because we think that job experience can start very early and set you up to also choose a quality career path while in college and help you get through the system. So for those reasons, we think that this bill is integral to a positive working experience and to a positive internship, which, like I said, we believe is interwoven into the fabric of a successful post-secondary education. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy to take any questions, but we hope that and encourage your support of House Bill 2669. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Bob.
Chair Doherty, members of the committee. My name is Bob Jundeff. I'm from Disability Rights Oregon. About a quarter of the work that we do is helping people with disabilities find work and stay in work. Since the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed back in 1990, one of the major efforts has been to get people with disabilities into jobs so that they can be more self-sufficient and less dependent upon public disability payments and other types of resources. Unfortunately, this has been a difficult road. Still today, the unemployment rate for people with disabilities who are ready and able to work is over twice that of people who are able-bodied, and that figure, unfortunately, is increasing. Since we've been in the economic dip, as everyone knows, and I'm an employer, so I experienced the same situation, is that there's more and more people who, because they can't go directly into jobs, have to rely upon internship opportunities in order to position themselves for later job opportunities. Not having the protections of disability laws for those individuals so that they can have the full experience and be fully competitive in the job market robs them of an opportunity to fully compete in the marketplace. That's why I would like to thank Representatives Fredericks and Matthews for coming forth with this bill, because it's very important to make sure that we continue to have an even playing field so that we can make some progress in terms of disability employment.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Wilson?
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, J.L. Wilson representing Associated Oregon Industries. This bill has a history. It was introduced in 2011, and where we left it at the end of 2011 was we wanted to fashion a policy surrounding the issue of sexual harassment in the workplace for interns. And I wanted to be very clear to this committee that this bill does basically everything but lend sexual harassment protections in the workplace to for interns. And so I wanted to be clear about that. But if the issue is a list of 659A protections for interns, our questions are simply, most of these we don't have objection with. They're mostly cut and dry. Elizabeth did a great job in demonstrating them to you, and they are in my written testimony. Our issue is just more one of question. What is the overarching policy? Why are some 659A protections included? Why are some excluded? And what is the policy framework we're trying to achieve? And I named a couple in my testimony. Why these protections and not 659A309, which is discrimination based on employment of another family member, or 312, which is leave of absence for bone marrow donation, or 320, which is discrimination based on information and a credit history. I guess I'm more curious why these lists of 659A protections and not the litany of others that are also included in the statute. My one admonition with regard to this particular bill is our concern around 659A030. Not so much as it relates to the protected class issues, but there's a phrase in that statute dealing with non-discrimination on wages, terms, conditions, or privileges of employment. And we're talking about wages, terms, conditions of employment, and yet there's not an employment relationship. And I think we're still trying to wrap our arms around what that means and what that portends for interns, because, you know, as Representative Frederick said, we're not making the case for discrimination, but what I will say is if you open up a new class of unintended lawsuits or unintended discrimination claims, internship possibilities will diminish. And I put on the front of my testimony, just so you're aware, how Boley interprets an intern, how they define an intern. And I would point out point number four, which an intern has to meet these tests, and that is that the employer derives no immediate advantage from the activities of the trainees, and on occasion, operations may actually be impeded. And so if you're opening up a class of unintended lawsuits, unintended consequences for a class of folks that will actually impede your operations, I think you can make a strong case that maybe those opportunities might diminish. And so I really just wanted to call your attention to 030 and what that might mean in terms of unintended consequences. But that is the heart of my testimony.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions of the panelists? Representative Matthews?
I just want to say, and herein lies the problem. You know, JL, and I appreciate the conversation we've had. We started with just the glaring fact of the lack of, protection from sexual harassment. And when you start to open that up and then you look at other things regarding disabilities and everything, you realize that the importance is to find protections in a lot of the areas. But he brings up good points. And as I said, he's never told me no, and I want to be clear about that. He's never said, I won't do it, we won't do it. We've been working on trying to get there, but I would sure like to get somewhere this session before we gavel out of this session and have no protections and have the same status quo we have right now.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, that's everyone signed up. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2669. And I will open up the first panel on House Bill 3390. And so that's Representative Dembro, Senator Rosenbaum, and Amanda Fritz, Commissioner Fritz.
Lose Senator Rosenbaum.
Who are you?
Did you? We'll find her again, but they temporarily lost her. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. It's a pleasure to be here. It's an honor for me to be here with one of my commissioners, Commissioner Amanda Fritz from Portland, who I think we all owe a very special thanks. Anyone who believes that the workers of Oregon need earned sick days, her hard work on getting the ordinance through in the city of Portland, not only bringing it into passage, but having it pass unanimously, was really quite an accomplishment and a real testament to her hard work. I regret the absence of Senator Rosenbaum because she was going to kick this off with the high moral tone. I was going to go into the weeds on the bill itself. So let me try to reach inside and see if I can reach that high moral tone.
We are comfortable with your...
Thank you, Chair Doherty.
Yes.
I said before that the workers of Oregon need access to earned sick days. Currently, in Oregon, at least a third of Oregon workers don't have access to a single earned sick day as part of their employment. And if you look at those who are working at the minimum wage level or something close to the minimum wage level, it's more like 80%. 80% don't have access to a single paid sick day, earned sick day. And what that means is that they will have to go to work sick or not be able to pay their rent. They will have to take their children to school, even if their children are sick, because they have no way to be able to care for that child, to stay home to care for that child, because losing a day's pay would be impossible for them. These issues are a challenge for us all, but they're particularly a challenge for those who are working down at the lower end of the earnings spectrum. This is a big, big problem, colleagues, and that's why it is, it's such a great thing that the city of Portland has passed its ordinance to create this program in Portland. One of the real challenges that the commissioners faced, and I think Commissioner Fritz can address this, is the pushback that they got from members of the business community who were concerned about Portland being a sort of island in the middle of Oregon in terms of how sick leave was going to be treated. And there were, you know, many pleas, I think, that the program that Portland was going to undertake needed to be a statewide program to allow, you know, particularly for those businesses that are, you know, parts of larger chains, to have consistency in their workplaces around the state, and to make sure that Portland wasn't unfairly disadvantaged. And so, you know, several of us legislators promised the commissioners that as soon as we could, we would bring this bill forward to them to try to take earned sick days and take that program statewide. And that's what House Bill 3390 does. The bill that you have before you, unfortunately, I think you've not received the amendments that we were hoping you would have received, except, as many of you know, the Legislative Council system crashed yesterday, and so you don't have those amendments before you. But, you know, I would be happy to go over, you know, the gist of those amendments, and actually they're reflected in the handout that I think, have you received that? Yeah, it's before you on the dais. The amendments incorporate some of the changes that were in the Portland ordinance because we wanted to try to bring this bill into consistency with Portland to a large extent. It also addresses a couple of issues that arose in the discussions in Portland that weren't able to get addressed there, that, you know, some concerns that, you know, we feel would get larger passage of this bill. So, you know, colleagues, I just want to say, you know, during last summer, as we were preparing for the November election, we did a lot of polling in the state. And, you know, I know that my party did polling that showed overwhelming support for earned sick days in this state. And I believe that if you look around the country, you will see that there is growing recognition among the cities and states that this is a problem that needs to be addressed. Just since Portland passed its ordinance, we've seen passage in New York City, Philadelphia. There are active campaigns in place around this state. I know in Eugene, Corvallis, Ashland. This is a problem that people are working to address. It would be great if we could come up with a way to address this in a statewide manner so that we would have consistency. With that, I will close for now, turn it over to Commissioner Fritz, and I'll be able to be happy to walk you through the details of the bill and the amendments as you'd like.
Good morning, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. Thank you so much for holding this hearing. I'm Portland City Commissioner Amanda Fritz, representing the Portland City Council. I'm inspired listening to the two previous bills that you heard, working on workers' rights, working on looking after people, treating people as human beings. And that's essentially what this bill does. It says that everybody gets sick sometimes. Everybody's kids get sick sometime. And we should not have folks who are sick coming to work. People shouldn't have to choose between paying their bills, keeping the roof over their head, and not getting fired. And I think really at the basic level, could we all agree that you shouldn't get fired if you call in sick when you go to for calling in sick when you have the flu? That's what it boiled down to for me. I'm a retired registered nurse. I worked in nursing for 27 years. I was 17 years a parent in Portland Public Schools. And for me, this is both a women's rights issue, and it's a personal, it's the right thing to do. And it's something that we're so far behind in this country. bastions of capitalism like Singapore offer paid sick leave to their employees. It's something that we need to do. Representative Dembro said that Portland shouldn't be seen to be unfairly disadvantaged. In my opinion, Portland shouldn't be the only city where workers have rights and where they have this particular right to be able to stay home. We heard from people who had been fired for calling in sick once after 3 years of exemplary working at a sandwich shop. I heard from workers who work two part-time jobs and neither of them offers any opportunity to take even an hour off when you have a migraine. And this is not small businesses. This is large multinational corporations. So this, and it's challenging to craft regulations that apply to both small businesses and large multinational corporations. But please do it. We puzzled through. We had a hearing in January 31st, and then we took 6 weeks before we passed our final ordinance because we did listen to businesses, large and small, from those who work in and out of the city of Portland. And we heard from many, don't do this. This shouldn't be. It's too difficult to figure out who works in Portland and who doesn't, and let's do it statewide. Indeed, that's what the Oregonian said. And yet 2 days ago, the Oregonian said, well, don't do it statewide either. It's the right thing to do. And one of my heroes, Eleanor Roosevelt, said, do what you believe in your heart is right because you'll be criticized anyway. And I believe that's what we're asking you, what I'm asking you to do, and to do it now because the need is urgent. And we can't have high school kids staying home to look after their little brother or sister because they need to be at school. And if mom and dad can't stay home, it's either take the kid to school and get all the rest of the class sick, or big brother or sister stays home. And with all of your commitment to education, this is something that actually does help with our high school graduation rate statewide. It helps with prosperity. The studies show that workers coming to work sick decrease the entire productivity of the workplace, both because you're looking after the person and because customers, frankly, don't like it when you're being sneezed on. So those are some of the reasons, and I could obviously go on and on. I urge you to pass this, and thank you very much for considering it in this committee.
Thank you. Are there any questions to the panelists?
I
have one. Did Portland, what if you have a business that financially cannot do this? Are there any stipulations for that in Portland, or
we looked at that.
Enforcement,
Commissioner Dan Feltzman and I held a task force that had a balanced membership of proponents and opponents, and we considered should this be something that you have to be financially able to do. We don't look at how financially viable businesses are when the minimum wage increases. This is we heard from a number of small and even starting businesses that they started off with doing this, and so it's something that you work into your business model. One of my constituents wrote me that for minimum wage jobs, this increases the minimum wage by about 15 cents an hour, which so it's still less than Washington's minimum wage.
Okay, so the answer is no.
The answer is no, sorry.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Madam Chair, if I could, let me just very quickly let the members know, the highlights of the bill. The bill covers workplaces that have six workers or more, and they don't begin become eligible for sick leave until they've worked for 90 days. So they have to have been working for 3 months. The idea is, someone who comes who doesn't work out, during that, initial churn of a new employee is not going to be eligible under this bill. One of the issues that came out in Portland was concern among restaurant owners that many of their employees would prefer to be able to trade shifts, right? Because they, for especially people who are working where a lot of their income is based on tips, the benefit of the earned sick leave is not going to compensate for the loss of tips, and so they would prefer, actually, rather than take the paid sick day to trade shifts. This bill allows them to do that. In the amended version, there are a number of elements of it to try to prevent casual, you know, taking of sick days. I mean, the goal is that this is a program that's there for people who really need it. If they're gone for more than 3 days, they have to have a note, you know, from a physician, you know, demonstrating their illness. They can't cash out the benefit. The benefit does not have a monetary value. There are other elements of, yes, the employer, if the employer notices a pattern of usage, then that employer can take action against that as an employment procedure. The fact is, though, colleagues, that if you look at the cities and states and countries that have had earned sick days, most employees do not use their full benefit here. I think the statistics show maybe half of what is eligible is what employees take. They tend to hold on to them for when they're really sick and not use them casually. This is something that employees and employers both can learn how to use responsibly, and that in a nutshell is the overview of the bill.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Any questions? Okay, so I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3390. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to open up some work sessions of bills that were held over, and we're going to reopen this when we've done our business. Okay, so I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2706. Jan, if you could summarize.
Madam Chair, committee members, this is a bill about the self-service storage facility. The committee adopted the Dash 1 amendment on Monday that required the notice for the foreclosure sale to be published in a newspaper of general circulation. There is no revenue impact on the bill with the Dash 1, and there is no fiscal impact.
Okay, fine.
Motion. Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2706 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Okay, Representative Barton moves House Bill 2706 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Madam mm-hmm. Chair, if I may.
Representative Widener.
I'll be supporting the bill today, but I'd like us to take a look at some of the fees that are charged for when they're having to actually put these ads in the papers. They said the max was $110. I've heard higher fees than that mentioned for different advertisement for papers that maybe we look at putting a cap, because these are mandated that they put these in the papers, and we need to look out for the companies that are having to place these ads. Especially when you get into other areas.
Are you going to propose an amendment, or?
Well, if you wanted to carry it over, we could do. I think the Senate can look at doing it. I don't know if we need to do it here. I don't want to slow it down, but
okay.
It's just something that I think is an issue that is out there.
Okay. Thank you. Any other discussion, Representative Kennemer?
Just a comment. Yesterday, I had occasion to talk with Mr. Barrows, and he supports the bill with the amendment. Maybe
thank
not
you.
His preference, but
jumping up and down.
But
thank you. Any other?
He was here, but he wasn't speaking, so I thought I'd speak on his behalf. He had
thank
mentioned
you.
That I could, so.
Thank you. Okay. Any other discussion? Further discussion? Okay. See none. Brandon, could you call the roll, please?
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Boldy.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Fagan.
Aye. Excused.
Representative Widener.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Kennemer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Aye.
Chair Representative Doherty.
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. Is there somebody who would like to carry this bill? We have no carrier. This was a committee bill. Okay, Representative Witt. You beat you to the punch.
No problem. I'm just fine.
Thank you very much. So Representative Witt. Okay, I'd like to open. Close the work session on that.
Yep.
Close work session on House Bill 2706, and open a work session on House Bill 2683.
Madam Chair, committee members, this bill authorizes the employer to pay wages through direct deposit, or if the employee agrees, they could pay it through another means of electronic transfer. The committee adopted on Monday the Dash 1 amendment. I think I just explained it, that you can pay through direct deposit without agreement of the employee, but you need the employee's agreement if you're going to pay through some other means. And there is no revenue impact. There is a minimal fiscal impact with no statement issued.
Okay.
Second motion.
Please.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2683 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Representative Barton moves House Bill 2683 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there any discussion? Okay. Seeing none. Brandon, could you call the roll, please?
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Fagan.
Excused.
Representative Widener.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Bolte.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Kenner.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Aye.
Chair Representative Durbin.
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. The carrier on this one, Representative Johnson?
It's his bill.
Representative Johnson's bill, so we'll sign it to him. Okay, close the work session on House Bill 2683 and open up a work session on House Bill 2448.
Madam Chair, committee members, this is a bill about expedited bargaining. The committee adopted the Dash 2 amendment on Monday that restores the bargaining period to 90 days, and it refers any unresolved matters to mediation before binding arbitration begins. There's no revenue impact. There is a fiscal statement issued.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2448 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation.
Okay, Representative Barton moves House Bill 2448 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation. Is there any discussion?
No.
Representative Witt, then Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, as we debated the Dash 3 amendment, I believe it was, I fail to see anything that is gained by allowing collectively bargained disagreements, or non-bargained, I guess, disagreements to percolate and bubble for an additional 30 days. I think it leads to a disharmony in the workplace, and I'm troubled by that. I will, however, be supporting the larger bill.
Okay, thank you. Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. I, unfortunately, was not here on the day when we heard all this, so I'm still kind of gathering information on this one and not ready to say yes yet. I just don't know where I'm going to be on the floor. So.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Any other discussion? Okay, seeing none. Brandon, could you call the roll, please?
Representative Holby.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Fagan.
Excused.
Representative Thatcher.
No.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Widener.
No.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Kenner.
Aye.
Chair Representative Doherty.
Aye. Okay, the motion passes. This is Thatcher. We'll have Representative Doherty carry this bill. How's that? Okay, I close the work session on House Bill 2448 and open a work session on House Bill 2903.
Madam Chair, committee members, this bill is one that requires employers to post a summary of the statutes and rules regarding employment rights in terms of domestic violence. The committee heard the bill in March, briefly discussed it on Monday. There was discussion as to whether it would be amended. There's no amendment before us today.
Okay,
there's no revenue impact. There is a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2903 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Representative Barton moves House Bill 2903 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Widener?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, I'm on this bill, but and a big supporter, but I think Bully needs to look at where we're doing just a single poster, because it's getting to be where you're wallpapering your room with this stuff, and we need to look at having a handbook that goes out that they disperse to employers that they could hand to employees when they're hired so they know what their rights are, rather than having this maze of posters all over a break room or someplace like that, and some places don't have break rooms, and they're having to look at restrooms where they're basically the public's going in and seeing them as well. So I think Bowling needs to take a good look at this and how they want to handle it and address it to make this easier for employers and employees to have the information on hand.
Okay, thank you. Other discussion? Representative Kinnamer.
Madam Chair, I want to thank you for holding the bill over as a courtesy for Representative Cameron, who was going to have an amendment. Apparently it's not prepared, so I think he can pursue that in the Senate if he wishes.
And I know that one of the concerns was whether businesses could get this in other form other than just email, and actually the bill does refer to having it mailed to them or sent to them in a hard copy form. And so that's something that they're working on, and that we did get some communication from Bowley that reflected that possibly what the concern was is already there. And my one concern is just because I have a business and I have a license through the city of Tigard, but I'm not required to have a license through the state of Oregon. So it would be very difficult for the state of Oregon to send me something because I don't know if they know I exist. City of Tigard does, but so. Representative Matthews.
And I appreciate that, Madam Chair. And I want to point out, and with respect to the comments from the good representative, I think it's impossible to expect Bowley to send out a handbook for every employee in the state. I think that would have a fiscal ridiculous. As a business owner, I do think, I agree, it'd be nice to condense these things. I don't necessarily think it's wallpapering the walls. I think the message gets missed, though, and it's lost opportunities. I would want to point out, though, as an employer, just having something available for me to download and print takes time, takes money, and so it's not exactly free. And it's got to be requested by the employer themselves. So there's some, you know, there's some issues, but in the end, I think it's the right step forward, and I'll be supportive.
Okay, thank you. Any other discussion? Okay, seeing none. Brandon, could you call the roll, please?
Representative Fagan.
Excused.
Representative Matthews.
Aye.
Representative Holtby.
Aye.
Representative Widener.
Aye.
Representative Pitt.
Aye.
Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Kinnamer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Representative Barton.
Aye.
Chair Representative Doherty.
Aye.
Okay, the motion passes. And we're going to ask Representative Tomei to carry this on the floor. Okay, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2903 and open up a work session on House Bill 3361.
So far.
Madam Chair, committee members, this is a bill that defines what a comparable community is for the purposes of arbitration involving Department of Corrections security employees. There's no amendment before you. There's no revenue impact. There is a fiscal statement issued.
Okay. And on this, we may have to carry this over just because for a Ways and Means referral, but I know that Mary Botkin wanted to speak on this issue before we went forward, and she might be next door in the overflow room. So if somebody could go get her.
I could add a little insight on this bill as well. It was my bill's chief sponsor. So
may I interrupt? She may actually be in the next hearing room. I was testifying while she was over there.
Oh, okay.
So.
Thank you. Representative Matthews.
Well, obviously, you know, our intent was to find a way to have comparables for the purpose of the collective bargaining for our corrections folks. And what we got back was an initial fiscal that was, when you consider other employee costs, it was roughly $95 million, which is a ridiculous fiscal given our situation. And so I'll let Mary testify on her own, but I will say that you know, we had to kind of reevaluate what we were asking for. Now, I'll say that I have some problems with the fiscal that was given by the agency, but I will also admit that there would probably be at least some fiscal associated. There would be anyway if we move forward, because it'd be on building the casket that this thing's going to sit in when it sits in this building. So with that being said, I'll turn it over to Mary, but there were some issues that came with the fiscal, so we've been talking.
Yes. And it was not an April Fool's joke.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Botka. I'm here representing AFSCME Council 75. Every once in a while in your career, you get a fiscal that makes you go, I'm going to need to nudge some numbers here. Then you get a fiscal that says, this is going to be a problem. And then you get a fiscal that all you can do is laugh. Because it is so bloody big, you cannot figure out how they got it. $100 million to suggest that on the list of comparables for our unit, we would include local government. Not that we would do it, but that we could do it. It is amazing to me. With me is Tim Mullery. Tim is our chief spokesperson at the bargaining table for the Department of Corrections. And he didn't laugh. He just got mad. And I never see Tim mad, so when he gets mad, I get scared. But it was the biggest fiscal in 30 years I've ever seen on a bill that I introduced, or that I had introduced. So, Tim, if you can explain sort of your frustration and...
Chair Dougherty, honorable members of the committee, Mary's right. I am the lead negotiator for AFSCME on the...
If you could identify yourself.
Tim Woolery, for the record, sorry.
Thank you.
I negotiate, I'm the lead negotiator for AFSCME at the security units table, representing 1,800 of the department's security staff. I've been involved in bargaining for close to 15 years with the Department of Corrections, and what happened in 1995 is there was a bill passed that changed how negotiations happen with the state of Oregon, and that bill set forth a series of criteria that an arbitrator, if an interest arbitration should occur, will evaluate. The number one criteria is what is the best for the people of the state of Oregon. And then there's secondary criteria, of which specifically listed for state workers is the surrounding states. Below that is a further secondary comparators, which include counties. There's no prohibition from us using counties currently. What this bill would do would specifically add the top three populous counties to the list of things that would be evaluated in our proposals to the state and the state's proposals to us. It wouldn't mean that we would automatically jump to whatever their level is. It would be an ability for us to specifically include comparison to them, which we already have implied or indirect comparison already. So I don't see this as something that would include a $100 million fiscal. Mm-hmm. I think that's ludicrous.
Okay. Representative Barton and Representative Widener.
Madam Chair, you know, it's almost, I almost feel bad piling on because it's almost cheap sport to just to bash the fiscals that we get from agencies. We all do it sometimes. Some are sometimes more deserved than others. And, you know, again, maybe there is a rationale. Having said that, on its face, this seems like one of the most ludicrous fiscals I've ever seen. It's clearly a top three all time for me. It's absurd. That's all.
Okay, Representative Widener, then Representative Thompson.
Looking through the fiscal, and we just kind of get a broad picture, as you know, when you get these back from them. And I have lots of problems with some of the fiscals, and I actually have lots of problems when they come in and say they're going to have savings, which you know aren't there, that are kind of made up because they go to the extreme sometimes. But do you have any idea what you think? Because, I mean, there were the salary differences that we were talking in committee when we had this in a hearing on this. Were fairly substantial. And did you guys calculate what you thought it might end up at? Because I'm looking at this and it doesn't really break down the, and it has the FTE and everything of 1,875 and the breakdown of how much for each one is, but did you guys kind of have a scope of where you thought it might be? Because it doesn't look totally ludicrous looking at it right here.
Chair Dougherty and Representative Widener, if I could answer that. When we pursue negotiations with the state of Oregon, one of the factors that we look at is how we compare with like classifications or in the surrounding states. We look at what positions are in county jails that are roughly equivalent to what we are, and we already do that. It is a fact that the top populous counties usually come out significantly higher in wages, but we also have to look at total compensation, what retirement is, vacation time off is, other paid time off. The whole package is what we look at. It's what the arbitrator would look at. It's what the DAS negotiators would look at as well. So in the past, we've used counties in our attempts to compare and make relatively good arguments of what we should be getting in terms of compensation. What the state does is they throw in a bunch of the least populous counties, which have much lower wages, and it just offsets each other to some degree. But what this bill would do, it would specifically have the top three populous counties, which are in reality who we're competing against for our recruits, as well as who or where our current employees leave to for better jobs.
Okay. Representative Thompson, did you have a question?
I think he just answered. I was just curious as to whether or not this fiscal was an admission that the agency thinks we're underpaying our corrections workers by $100 million. You know? That is a budget issue. You know, but
passing on to the governor, let him figure it out.
Madam Chair, Representative Thompson, I have to say that when I sort of looked at this, I thought, oh my goodness, Tim's negotiating for sweat wages. He's running sweatshops in the prisons, and I thought, you know, but it is stunning.
Representative Thatcher.
Piling onto the fiscal issue, well, we've all received fiscals that we think are ridiculous, but sometimes it just comes down to a matter of a word and an interpretation. And have you gotten together with the agency to say, you know, what up here?
Madam Chair, Representative Thatcher, yes, actually, the next day, I got the fiscal about 20 minutes before the hearing, and so it was stunning to me. And after the hearing, I expressed my concern over what I thought was a ridiculous amount of money and suggested that they redo their fiscal and relook at the numbers. I have not received any response. Well, in fairness, Cindy Booth, their lobbyist, did say she would take that back to the Dome Building and ask them to look at it again. I just haven't gotten a response yet. And I did go down the hall to the fiscal officer and asked him where on earth they got the numbers that they had come up with. And he did indicate that he was surprised at the level, that he was a little surprised at the amount of money that was included. And that he had just gotten the numbers from the DOC, that he had not, you know, that he just checked their math rather than their assumptions. I have no idea what they were thinking about with this.
I think part of it is, if I may, is that there's a factor. There's about 2,300 employees. So Rep. Widener was saying, if you just look at the numbers, it can add up to a significant amount. But that doesn't mean that that's what we're going to obtain through negotiations across the table or through an arbitration. So I think it's a far-fetched idea.
Okay. Thank you. Well, and the one thing, and it just, I mean, I've dealt with arbitrations that have done with comparable work, and it's one of those tools that you use that, you know, and sometimes, of course, we want to use the comparables that make us look, you know, bad compared to other people. But in the long run, what it is the comparables are there. You present it to the arbitrator weighs both sides, and I was looking at this, and if it goes up to $100 million, I mean, that's like $43,000 a year, you know, fiscal per employee if we're looking at the 1,800 corrections officers.
I'm thinking about finding a new job if they're going to get a $43,000 a year raise.
So anyway, Ms. Bodkin did want to go through and deal with the fiscal because it was something that when I saw it, I thought, I had gotten it from Representative Matthews and thought that he was indeed pulling a prank on me on Monday, and it was not a prank.
I'm not that way.
So anyway, it's one that we can't move because it would obviously need a referral to Ways and Means, but
maybe. And I appreciate coming and explaining. Representative Matthews, through the chair, has been gracious enough to say that he is more than willing to revisit this issue with us in a subsequent session, be it February or whenever. And we thought we had this pretty well thought out. Clearly not enough. So we will continue to work the issue. And I want to thank you, Madam Chair, and the committee for joining me in my piling on of the fiscal that was, you know, one can only say excuse me, but it is the fiscal from hell. There's just nothing we can do with it except say we'll see you next time and we'll figure out a different way to get there.
Thank you, Juana. Okay, thank you very much. Okay, with
that, Madam Chair, is it safe to say we're not going to send this to Ways and Means fast and let them figure it out?
There's no money for the casket, Representative.
Okay, so I close the work session on House Bill 3361, and I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3390, or reopen the hearing. And we've got a lot of people that want to speak. We do need to be out of here at about at 5 minutes till, so I will cut off the hearing at that time. And we go back and forth and back and forth. So we have the initial panel to speak. And so the next panel that we have to speak in opposition, and we have these just because they signed up first, was Ian Tolleson, John Zaleski, and Doug Kramer. And they could be next door.
Maybe you could read a couple of the lists beyond so we can get people organized,
okay,
too. That would save a little bit of time to expedite
there.
This.
And then the next panel that would be up after these, what we call it, on deck, which is very appropriate for this time of the year. Anna Steve Vodder, Bobby Weber, Andrea Peluso, and Susan Lund are on deck. Roman?
Chair Doherty, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Ian Tolleson with Oregon Farm Bureau. Here to testify in opposition on the House bill in front of you. I submitted a letter for the record with a coalition of members that oppose this, so I will not go into great detail, and I have some farmers here that will talk about how this would affect their farm business, so I'll let them do that. I would like to put on the record that this is a mandate that would have to be paid by the employers, or the small farmers in our case. And this could be a question of do we hire another employee or let one go, or adhere to the new law. So I just want to make sure that people know that there is a real question there that will affect employment in this state. And with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Doug Kramer. Thank you.
Chairman Doherty, members of the committee, I am Doug Kramer. I reside at 19664 Arbor Grove Road, St. Paul. I'm a blueberry farmer. I'm also a board member of Oregon Department of Agriculture, but I am here today representing myself as a private citizen. I am president of Berries Northwest. We grow blueberries here in Oregon. I have three locations in Linn County, Marion County, and Columbia County. We hire both full-time and seasonal employees, and for the record, I've never dismissed an employee for calling in sick. With that being said, we don't have paid sick leave for our hourly employees, especially during harvest. Many of our blueberries get harvested with a machine, and those machines take five people to operate them. And if one of the workers calls in sick, I have to put another worker on that machine because, as you probably know, blueberries are a very time-sensitive crop, and I can't stop the work just because an employee does call in sick. I bring a worker in that is doing a different type of work that day that may not be as time sensitive, and use that worker in place of the one that would have called in sick. Agriculture is a price taker. We sell our blueberries wholesale, both fresh and frozen. And that price, usually I have no idea what the price is going to be till sometime after I've harvested the crop. In the case of my fresh blueberries, about 3 weeks. In the case of my frozen blueberries, maybe up to 60 days after I've harvested the crop. So to adjust my labor force for any increased cost that I incur, I don't even know what the change in cost is going to end up doing to my net values until well after this happens. For these reasons, I am opposed to paid sick leave. Again, I want to stress we have no problem with employees calling in and letting us know that they're sick and doing our best to shuffle duties and responsibilities, but to pay twice with an employee that's out sick seems like a high cost to our business. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Chair Doherty and committee, good morning. My name is John Zielinski. I am the president of Marion County Farm Bureau. I farm with my two brothers just northeast of Salem here. We grow pears, apples, peaches, and pumpkins. I reside at 5270 55th Avenue Northeast. Oregon agriculture is a big industry, but it's made up of 40,000 small farm businesses. For these small farms to absorb the expenses that House Bill 3390, the sick leave bill, would cause, would be very difficult. There are three ways small business of any type, including agriculture, will pay for this raise. One would be to raise price. Two, cut cost. Three, reduce your net. For most of ag, raising price is not an option. We grow commodity crops, as Doug just illustrated, with prices determined on a regional or even national level. Oregon has the second highest minimum wage in the nation, the highest unemployment taxes of all 50 states. Oregon ag is already at a competitive disadvantage.
If we have your written testimony, if you could please summarize.
Sure.
What we have. Thank you, sir.
All right. Weather can be very crucial in harvesting a crop, and we need all people present when that, if there's a rainstorm coming, a strawberry grower needs to get those berries off. They don't have until the next day. They need everyone there when it's possible to get that crop into the processor. Let's see. One of my other concerns would be if there's a situation where the season is coming to an end. I can understand sick leave. Not that I would agree with it, but I can understand sick leave in an ongoing employment situation where someone's employed year-round. However, if someone were employed seasonally and they know the end of the season is coming, will they take their sick days at the very tail, leaving the farmer high and dry? It's just a question. I don't think that Oregon agriculture can afford this measure, and I thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions of the panelists? Representative Barton.
Gentlemen, thank you for coming in. A question, I think, zeroing in on, I believe, Mr. Zielinski, correct?
Yes.
Mr. Zielinski's statement. So the bill as drafted, my understanding, we haven't seen the amendments, is that it attaches at 90 days. And my understanding, again, I'm no farmer, so correct me if I'm wrong, is that the vast majority of your workforce is seasonal in nature, which is, I think, what you address. What if this committee were to amend it to be a different number, say 120 days, 150 days, or even 180 days? I think that would then, would that then exempt a large portion of your workforce from this bill? And if so, would the Farm Bureau potentially either support this bill or at least be neutral?
I would not see support of the bill because there are many agricultural enterprises that are have a year-round workforce. Ourselves in the orchard industry, we employ a number of people year-round because we have pruning, thinning in the spring, harvest starting with peaches ending in November, peaches in June, ending the first week of November with apples. So we have a crew year-round. So there are some crops that might be might solve their issue, but it wouldn't solve the issue for all agriculture. So I do not see that Oregon Farm Bureau would be able to support that.
Yeah. Chair Doherty, Representative Barton. I would just agree. I mean, Oregon Farm Bureau represents all kind of farmers, small, big. Mm-hmm. We have people that employ year round and some that don't. And I think that's our biggest concern is just how would you make this work in practice. I think the spirit of the bill is well intended. However, just the implementation of it is very problematic in our industry. So I think maybe for some, I don't know the days, that might be something, but there's a large number of farmers that wouldn't work. Okay, but I appreciate the question.
Thank you. Okay, any other questions? Representative Widener?
Just like to thank Mr. Kramer coming here and representing the blueberry farmers since my younger brother works for Hearst International knows your company well.
Okay, thank you. Representative Holby.
Thank you. I appreciate your concern for your bottom line. I think that's important to consider. But I'm curious, one of the, I guess, concepts behind this bill is that workers have a very difficult time absorbing the loss of wages as well, and so they're compelled to go to work sick, essentially, and the productivity of that worker and the risk that worker then spreads the illness to other workers seems like it would also have an impact to your bottom line of productivity, maybe not on the machine, I don't know, but or maybe the machine's dangerous, and a sick person on a dangerous machine may be an issue as well. So I'm just wondering whether, that comes into your calculation of this issue, that in fact there may actually be a benefit to making sure that worker stays at home and gets better faster and when they do come back to work is more productive and doesn't drag out to a less productive workforce for you. I'm just wondering whether that thought process has come into this discussion for you.
Chairman Doherty, Representative Holby. In my operation, we do not encourage our workers to come to work sick. We do provide flexible hours, especially during harvest time, and so some of the workers might work some shorter days, some workers work, take some time off during the week, and they work weekends, and so usually if a worker does have to take some time off because they're sick, it really is not a problem to make up those days and hours at another point in time. So we've never had a worker come up and complain to us. But, you know, I realize maybe they never would, but, you know, at this point in time, our workers, when they are sick, they tend to stay home, and when they get back to work, they ask for some extra hours if they need them, and it usually hasn't been a problem.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
We're running short on time, so thank you very much. Okay, on deck after the we've got the panel coming, the panel four, and then after that, the people on deck are J.L. Wilson, Joe Gilliam, and Jan Meekum. But now we have Anna Steinwoffer, Bobby Weber, Andrea Peluso, and Susan Lynn. And if you have written testimony, if you could summarize in 2 minutes.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Peluso. I'm the Executive Director of Family Forward Oregon and the Coalition Chair for the Everybody Benefits Coalition for Earned Sick Time. I first of all want to thank all of the folks who got childcare, missed work, have left their places of business to come down and testify and be here and support in this room and also in the overflow space today. It wasn't easy. I appreciate folks being here. I'd like to start by just briefly summarizing my testimony, and then I also have two documents to submit for your review today. One was submitted in advance by economist Mary King. I want to summarize a couple of points from that, and some research about a cost-benefit analysis produced by the Institute for Women's Policy Research that talks about the real cost of the amended bill that's before you today. Let's just start by thinking for a second. I won't ask folks to raise their hand. How many of you in this room have been sick this year with a cold, a flu, norovirus? This is an inevitable human condition. Sickness happens. I think it's really important in the context of the testimony that you hear today that we always consider that we should not be incentivizing or encouraging a business practice that relies on the exploitation of sick and poor workers. We should not be incentivizing or encouraging business practices that do not acknowledge for the fact that humans get sick, and we need ways in which to deal with that. And I also want to acknowledge that it is a challenge to get workers to speak up on this issue. They are, we've talked to hundreds of workers who have experienced the kinds of working conditions that were just discussed, who do show up to work sick, who do fear firing, who don't raise the issue with their employer for fear that they will be there will be retribution, which is exactly the problem this bill seeks to address. So an employer's bottom line is certainly important to this conversation, but there are multiple bottom lines that need consideration, those of workers who are struggling to make ends meet, those of employers who are doing the right thing by giving their employees access to sick time, but are competing in a market where that's not the standard, and the community's bottom line when disease spreads or healthcare costs increase. So this is an issue of public health, social justice, and equity. So to jump in quickly to the data, I want to let you know that this analysis, the cost-benefit analysis that's before you, has amended data in the second and third pages, that remove Portland numbers. So the original estimate was that almost 600,000 workers across the state do not have access to paid sick time from their jobs. And when you take out the folks who will be covered by the Portland ordinance, we're looking at an additional 314,000 workers across the state, or 53% of private sector workers who do not have paid sick time from their jobs. Francisco Lopez, who's the executive director of CAUSA, was going to be here to testify today, but he's home with a sick child. He, if he were here, would tell you that 66%, as this study says, of Latino workers do not have paid sick time from their job. 79%, nearly 4 out of every 5 of workers who earn less than $20,000 a year do not have paid sick time from their work. Nearly half of those earning between $20,000 and $35,000 a year do not have paid sick time. This means the folks at the lowest end of the pay scale who are least able to float unpaid time off are the ones most likely not to have paid sick time. The industries least likely to offer paid sick time are food service, agriculture, protective service occupations, personal care occupations.
Andrea, if you could summarize, please.
Yes, and other service industry occupations. So these are clearly people who have the most direct and ongoing contact with the public. Quickly, women continue to be overrepresented in part-time and low-wage positions and are least likely to have sick time despite having the greatest primary care giving responsibilities. This cost-benefit analysis estimates that the amended version of the bill before you costs employers on average 22 cents per hour to implement. The benefits through reduced turnover and reduced contagion and spread of disease in the workforce is 23 cents an hour. So there's a net savings in addition to a $24 million savings to the community in reduced emergency room visits and spread of disease. I'm happy to, if I could just read four key points from
actually,
this.
Actually, you're going to be, you can, but somebody else will not be able to testify.
Okay. I just, I will just really quickly say that I'm submitting for your review of a letter from 14 different local economists in Oregon and Washington who estimate that the cost of extending paid sick days to employees is quite small and much less than business lobbyists have forecasted. The minor direct costs to employers are outweighed by the decrease in business costs resulting from reduced turnover, increased productivity. This is a summary, sorry. And that business costs don't reflect the considerable reduction in health care costs.
We have the testimony.
All right, thank you
very
so much.
Thank you. Chair Doherty and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Anna Stiebotter. I'm a public health nurse. I am here today to testify on behalf of both the Oregon Nurses Association and the Oregon Public Health Association in support of House Bill 3390. So as you've started to hear about this morning, many, many workers in Oregon don't have access to earned sick days, which means many workers are going to work sick. Many low-wage workers are choosing between paying their bills and or going to work sick. Many parents are choosing to send their sick kids to school. You don't have to be a nurse or a public health professional to know that that's not good for the public's health. This bill will help to ensure that more workers are able to stay home when they are sick. I think this bill is an important way to support our healthcare transformation efforts in Oregon. We're working to focus on prevention. If people aren't able to go to receive the care they need, the preventive and primary care that they need, people are going to be forced to get sicker, which would lead to more expensive care and long-term health risks. I just wanted to give a brief typical example, not because it's particularly alarming, but I think this is happening every day. I was on a home visit with a young mom and her one-year-old. She's asking me, you know, how sick do you think my baby is? They both have fevers. I'm talking to them about the risk, when they should go to the hospital, when they should go to the doctor, when they should give medications. And then she cut our visit short because she said, I'm on my way to work. I need to get to work. And I said, neither of you should be going. You shouldn't be going to work. Your kids shouldn't be going to childcare. But this just wasn't an option for her. She was at a job working in a fast food restaurant. She didn't have earned sick days. She needed to pay the bill. She needed to get to work. I think this is happening every day. So as a public health nurse, I've spent my career working with low-income, high-risk moms and children in Oregon. I teach them about the importance of healthy habits. I provide support and encouragement as they make changes in their behavior. I assist them in accessing community resources. But unfortunately, if our state doesn't support healthy lifestyles through policies like the earned sick days,
if you could summarize, please.
I'm almost done. Many of the families I work with will not have a fair chance at good health. I'd encourage you to help make families healthier in Oregon by supporting this bill. Thank you. Okay,
thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Witt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Was it Anna?
Uh-huh.
Anna, thank you. As one of a handful of House members who received food poisoning in this building late last week, public health issues are very current for me. And we've received testimony this morning that blueberries, pears, apples, peaches are grown, and I'm just wondering if you could highlight the importance of keeping sick people away from food products that may be unprocessed and, in fact, eaten raw.
Extremely briefly.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know, I think it's probably obvious, but maybe hearing it from a nurse makes it more official. The farming, you know, fast food, people working with children in child cares, people working in home care, taking care of sick people, I mean, you do not want these illnesses spread. This is, the public health message is to stay home when you're sick because we know that that works, that that's going to keep the communities healthy, and I think this is an opportunity to really make an impact impact community-wide to keep people healthier.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank
Any
you.
Other questions? Okay.
Should we pay her the same as the doctor for that?
Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Okay, J.L. Wilson, Joe Gilliam, Jan Meekums, and then on deck is Bill Dickey, Tony Fuentes, Melissa Earlbaum, and Leslie Lindbergh Harper. And also for the record, that we will keep the record open for written testimony for the rest of the week. So anyone who has written testimony will keep it open for the week.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson with Associated Oregon Industries. This is a small business bill. This bill is extremely personal to me and our family, and I want to relay this to you because we own a company that will be subject to this regulation. We have a 15-employee broadcasting company in Tiny Grants Pass, Oregon. We are a substantial business in that part of the world, in a depressed part of the state. The 15 jobs are very meaningful jobs. In our tiny market, for the 100,000 listeners that we're all scrambling for, 24 competitors, most of them out-of-state, large broadcasting companies that offer usually a canned or automated product that's piped into our marketplace. So it's a hyper-competitive market. We are a long-standing small business that has fought to compete in that market dynamic now since the 1960s, since actually 1957. So this is an extremely sensitive issue for us, and I want to demonstrate how this issue is bad for us as a company, bad for our employees, and bad for the community. I want to be clear about what our workplace policies are. We offer 2 weeks of vacation pay. We do not offer paid sick leave, but that does not mean that our employees do not get paid sick time off. Our policy is simply this: if you're sick, we pay you to stay home. That is our policy. We're probably one of those statistics that's mentioned that our workers aren't covered under a paid sick leave policy, but that is the policy of our radio stations. If you're sick, you're paid to stay home because it's not right that you be at work. And that is the dynamic of small business in Oregon today. Now, how will this issue impact us as a company? First of all, understand this is essentially a 3% payroll tax on small business that my big competitors don't have to pay. Okay, the big broadcasting companies based in Texas or wherever, that they don't have to pay it because they're not locally based. They might not even have employees in Oregon, but you just disadvantage my small business to the tune of 3% of payroll to compete against the big boys, so to speak. And that is a disadvantage to small business. How do our employees get hurt? Understand this. Our 2 weeks vacation policy, if this measure were to pass, look at the decisions that we have to make on the margins. I mean, we're not going to be able to revenue our way out of this situation with this mandate. So the issue is, how do you control costs at the margins? Well, it's going to come through a number of ways. Our 2 week vacation policy will likely become a 1 week sick policy and a 1 week vacation policy. That is a very realistic outcome. I also would ask you to understand that decisions on benefits are made at the margins. It is a very tough decision to do things like insure dependents on an annual basis, and those decisions have to come into play. We also have the option of automating. Because we're at 15 employees now, we would love to be at 19 or 20 when we're really rocking and rolling. But the decision to automate then comes into play. So I just want you to be aware of what it is to compete in a competitive marketplace and what this does to small business relative to our larger competitors, and take that into consideration from just one rural Oregon business. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Meekum?
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jan Meekums, the State Director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. But I'm speaking on behalf of testimony you have in front of you of 17 business associations representing thousands of small businesses in the state of Oregon. And I think it's really critical to communicate that this is a small business state, that 97.6%, and you know this, of all employers are small business employers. But a key point is that 77,000 Oregon businesses employ less than 20 employees, and they would be tremendously impacted by this bill, and they represent 310,000 employees. some of the key points I cannot articulate as well as a real live example that JL just did in generalities, but it is a true fact that this bill will cause people to lose their lives. A study that was done for Colorado, they estimated that of paid sick leave and the effect it would have on employment, that they figured between 2012 and 2016 that they would lose 14,000 jobs as a result of that. Oregon cannot afford to lose any more jobs. We have consistently had higher employment than the national average. Although we're second in minimum wage, we are below the national average in income per capita. Oregon simply cannot afford this bill. Small businesses cannot afford this bill. And with that, I'll leave you with my written testimony, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, for the record, Joe Gilliam with Northwest Grocery Association. I'll be the one Gilliam in the building that'll be concise and to the point today.
And that is a nice change. Thank you very much.
We all appreciate that.
Yeah, but do smile for the camera, please.
Remember, I had to sit next to him.
I had to sleep next to him, so I don't know. And I digress. Anyway,
thank
back
you.
To the point.
Your testimony, sir.
Madam Chair, I did sit on the Portland Task Force on the sick leave, and we went through a myriad of lists and things to go down. The Portland measure does come up short in several ways and has unintended consequences. So my suggestion to you in my written testimony is how to make a bad ordinance a good bill. How do you make it work? And it's going to be tough statewide. We'd like to see a statewide policy, actually, and not have the Portland policy and see it preempted. But you got to define who you're going after. I think the first thing that everybody agrees on, no matter what side of the table, is unpaid sick leave. You should not be fired if you take an unpaid day and you have to go and take your kid to the doctor or you got sick or whatever the case may be. If you're a victim of a domestic violence, you're trying to find a place to live, you shouldn't lose your job because you got to take day off to go get a court injunction. Everybody agreed on that, so that should be the baseline of the policy. On the paid side, we would rather not see a business size, an employee size. If you're trying to target who doesn't have sick leave today, you're looking really at a wage scale. You're not looking at the size of business. So we'd rather see it based on some formula of the minimum wage that the bill would apply to. Once you get above that, let employers negotiate, let employers state a policy, as long as there's some minimums required, and I have some minimums in my list here. 180 days is a big issue because you're really looking at seasonal, and you really will help some agriculture, but also seasonal workers versus the 90 days. It's not long enough. And you need to look at exemptions because the one-size-fits-all policy in Portland's not going to work. You need to look at paid time-off policies. You need to look at stagehands. You need to look at hiring halls for construction. You need to look at CBA agreements because those are negotiated.
If you could summarize, please.
Tim from AstroMeet said a very important thing. Everything's looked in a big package. You don't want to state a policy that's going to take away other benefits because there's going to be a give and take. You need protection, and you also need what they did not put in Portland was abuse. On when that can be used, if it's going to be paid first day, there needs to be some things on the other side of the table to prevent abuse. And a statewide policy should come out and have local preemption from any other policies. You need a statewide policy. If we're going to govern it and be able to apply it, that's what businesses really need.
Okay, thank you. Any quick, very quick questions?
Real quick question, and since you were on the panel, this will be to you. Is it your impression that if we were to come up with a statewide policy that might be different from Portland and perhaps not what they wanted to do, that they'd be willing to roll theirs back and do what we say, you know, for the state? That you heard the testimony earlier, they'd like to see it statewide. Was it your impression from working with Portland that they might be willing to accept that as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Matthews, I think the majority of the council would be. I wouldn't say it would be unanimous, but I think a majority of the council would. And what they stated to us was, if there's a statewide policy, we want to have something in the hopper.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. Okay, next we have Bill Dickey, Tony Fuentes, Melissa Earlbaum, and Leslie Lindbergh Harper. And this, depending on how long it takes, may be the last panel. Thank you.
They cut me out.
Yeah, we're getting you one. Thank you. Okay, if you could begin, please.
Okay. Hi. Good morning, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. My name is Leslie Lindbergh Harper, and I'm an instructional assistant for the Salem-Keizer School District. As an educator, I know firsthand that healthy kids learn better. When a student comes to school sick, they can't focus, they recover from illnesses slower, and they get their fellow students and staff sick. For too many parents, staying at home to care for a sick child means losing needed pay or even the risk of losing their job. We see students come to school sick all the time because their parents would lose their jobs if they missed work. Sometimes a sick child does stay home, but their older sibling also stays home to care for the younger sick sibling. All of these solutions are disruptive to the kids' health and the learning environment at school. Teachers and school staff have to focus energy on keeping kids comfortable instead of on teaching. Being at school sick is not restful for the children, and they do not come to school ready to learn. Research shows low-wage workers are less likely to have access to paid sick leave. This forces many parents to make an impossible decision between earning a paycheck or caring for a sick child. We need to take steps to make sure they can do both while removing a learning barrier for low-income students. Research also shows that a parent's care helps kids recover more quickly, yet right now, only some parents have that option. Nationally, more than half of working parents don't have even a few paid sick days to care for a sick child. And we know that matters because research shows that parents without paid sick time are twice as likely to send a sick child to school than parents who do earn paid sick time at work. The inequitable impact on the low-income kids in our schools is clear. Our students learn better when they're healthy. The House Bill 3390 is a common-sense proposal that will make it easier for our parents to care for their sick children without jeopardizing their economic security. No parent should be forced to send a sick child to school or leave them home alone because they can't afford to miss a day's work. We can and should fix this for our students and families. On behalf of the Oregon Education Association and educators from around the state, we ask that you support House Bill 3390. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Next.
Hi, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. My name is Tony Fuentes. I'm a small business owner in Portland, Oregon. I'm also the president of the Voice Business Alliance. It's a 200-member business association in the Portland metro area. And that alliance supports this bill and supported the ordinance in Portland. And myself, as a small business owner, I own a number of businesses, but the most visible one is Milagros Boutique. We're a boutique in Northeast Portland with 7 employees, all of whom are hourly paid. We have provided paid sick leave, earned sick time to our workforce for our 10 years in business, and I can assure you it hasn't pushed us out of business. We have made it through this economic downturn without any trouble, and the cost of providing this benefit to our workforce has penciled out to about 1% of personnel cost. So there's a lot of knee-jerk reaction with regards to what the bill is going to do to the economy or to jobs or to people's existing policies in the workplace. And just like we saw these same kind of reactions to the Portland bill, and unfortunately, I think a lot of times people aren't actually taking the time to read the actual document, to read the actual bill, and see how it may actually apply to them. There's probably a lot of employers who are going to be coming to you saying that it's going to destroy their business, and in fact, they're already providing this benefit. I came into this, and I'm here as a volunteer, and you know, I was on the panel with Joe. There's a lot of people here who have volunteered their time to be here to support the bill. A lot of people don't have people walking around the halls here to represent them. I've seen the benefits that Representative Holvey identified as he talked to the farmers, and I can tell you that as a community member, as a business owner, I just can't fathom the idea that the working poor should also be the working well sick poor. And the reality is that those are the people who are most affected by the lack of earned sick time now. That's 80% of low-income workers do not receive a single minute of paid sick time and have to make a decision regarding whether they'll pay their rent or go to work sick.
If you could summarize, please, sir.
Certainly. And as an employer who provides this benefit and allows my workers to stay home and take care of their children, take care of themselves, it also hurts me that I have to send them out into the world where other employers are not doing this. And so that they come back sick. I send my kids to school, they come back sick. I let my employees stay home, they send their kids to school, the kids come back sick. We need to have a policy at the state level that provides protection for all Oregon workers, and I ask for your support of HB 3390. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Doherty and members of the committee. My name is Melissa Earlbaum. I'm the Executive Director for Clackamas Women's Services and also a Westland resident. And I'm here in support of House Bill 3390. I'll keep my comments brief. I think it's an important piece of legislation to help survivors of domestic and sexual violence seek really critical public safety services that are often only available during normal business hours. For example, an average amount of time it takes to get a protective order, a restraining order in Clackamas County can be just over 7 hours. That paid, earned paid time off is really critical so that women, men facing abuse don't have to choose between feeding their children and getting that protective order or working with law enforcement to hold their victim or their abuser accountable, that they can seek the support and safety that they need to be able to leave the situation. So this this bill has implications across multiple populations, as you're hearing, but I think it also provides protection and support for some of our most vulnerable populations. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair Doherty and committee, my name is Bill Dickey. I own a printing company in Portland, Oregon. I'm here to speak in favor of 3390. I think the, to comment on the previous testimony from the my friend from Grants Pass in the broadcast business, he offers this already. He offers paid vacation time. Paid vacation time is paid time off. So he is already doing what this bill is going to offer. And I think that it's really confusing for people that don't understand that if they offer paid vacation, they offer paid time off. They offer paid sick leave. It's just that your employee gets to choose to take a vacation day when they don't feel good. I have been in business in Portland and in Oregon for 35 years, and in every single business I have ever owned, managed, or worked at, we've offered paid sick leave. That includes small restaurants, printing companies, you name it. I mean, it's, and so what this does is it levels the playing field. For all of us that already offer this to our employees, everybody else should be doing this as well. The example that I give, that I gave when I testified for this in front of in Portland was that, you know, workers' compensation insurance is a mandatory thing. And paid sick leave should be a mandatory thing too. Businesses will correct their model to cover this policy. It's possible to do it because many of us already offer the policy. So if you've got a business model, you need to take into account that you're going to pay your employee when they need a day off for whatever the purpose. You know, whether they're sick, they need some break time, whatever. We ask them to work really hard on occasion, and in return, they get to ask us for a day off when they don't feel good. That's just it. It's just that simple. Thank you.
Okay, fine. Thank you. Are there any questions of the panelists? Okay, thank you very much. We probably only have time for two more people to speak, and so we have Susan Lund is here, and then next on the list is Midge Purcell. Please. Or Midge's stand-in. Unless your name is Midge. Thank you very much. If you could summarize, please. You guys got about 2 minutes.
I apologize for the confusion when my name was called earlier.
Okay.
I've been working for the same grocery store for 15 years, and while I have some paid sick hours, I can't use them until the third day that I'm sick. On top of that, I have to bring a doctor's note. Or else they don't let me back. I can't afford to lose 2 days' pay, and I can't afford to go to the doctor on top of that. I do go to work sick. My children have been sick. I've had to send them to school sick. My youngest son has been in a bully situation that I've unfortunately had to take time off. As a result, I took what was considered to be too many unpaid sick days. I was written up and told that I was on a slippery slope and I need to be careful. This is devastating to me and I need my job. Paid sick days would make a difference to me and so many others. Thank you for taking my testimony into consideration. And my name is Susan Lund for the record.
Thank you very much.
Chair Doherty and members of the committee, my name is Ty Schwafferman. I am standing in for Midge Purcell. I'm the health equity organizer with the Urban League of Portland, and we are testifying in support of HB 3390. And I didn't want to read the full summary, so I'm just going to give one example. The Urban League receives a number of phone calls every day from community members who feel that they've experienced discrimination within their workplace. And we have one example of a young lady who, you know, wasn't really welcomed in her workplace. She was determined to keep her job. She was determined to kind of see it through, and she really needed the income. So she worked through it. But one thing that happened is that the supervisor, you know, once she got sick, used that as an excuse to write her up and eventually terminate her position. You know, that's just unacceptable. I think the, you know, within our community, African Americans who are unemployed take on an average of about 10 months to find a new employment. So, you know, just with this example, I want you all to think about, you know, really, we don't want to penalize folks for being sick. So thank you.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. Any questions of the panelists? Okay, thank you.
One comment. It sounds like under the bill, it would still be allowed for employers to question and maybe have the same situation happen. Anyway, maybe it's just not question, but for comment. Or it sounds like it could still happen.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much. With this, I close the public hearing on House Bill 3390. And we couldn't get everybody's testimony in, but we did get most of their written testimony. And as I said earlier, that the written testimony or the written record will be open for the rest of the week for people that want to submit written testimony. Thank you. Thank you very much for coming down here and doing your Democratic duty. Thank you. I close the committee on the House Committee on Business and Labor for April 3rd, 2013.
Hey. Thank you.